Thank you, Leonard. I deeply appreciate the invitation to come and share a little bit about the research I've done the last few years on Pierre Goodrich. I want to thank the Philadelphia Society. I was concerned that I would come here and not know anyone because I've never been to a meeting before, the Philadelphia Society, but in fact, I see a lot of familiar faces, and it's very nice and comforting to see them. Jim Heinisch, who I worked with on Senator Coates' staff out in Washington for 2 years, and Stephen Tonser. Many of you, or some of you here today, I've interviewed in doing research on a biography I've been writing on Mr. Goodrich, and in fact, I feel as though you should be up here instead of me, because many of you who knew Mr. Goodrich personally, in fact, would you be willing, all those of you who knew Mr. Goodrich, would you raise your hand so I can get some sort of idea? Okay, at least half. Thank you. You're probably one of the most well-informed groups that I could possibly speak to. I only spoke one other time about Mr. Goodrich, and that was to the Women's Club in Winchester, Indiana, who I think was looking for a program and at the last minute heard that I'd been doing this research. So many of them knew Pierre Goodrich, but not quite in the way that I think you do. They remember Pierre when he was a younger man, and many of them in their 80s and 90s, some of his philosophy, I think, went over their heads a little bit. So anyhow, I do appreciate the opportunity to come in and share with you. I'm going to give you a little different perspective on Mr. Goodrich than you'd probably get from anyone else, simply because I am from his hometown and was raised there. While I never knew Mr. Goodrich personally, I knew a lot of his family members, and it's interesting to talk to people who knew Mr. Goodrich when he was a young man. I've interviewed or corresponded with over 100 people in the last 4 years. The oldest person was 101. She went to school with Pierre when he was in elementary there in Winchester. People like Robert Ward, John Macy, Francis Simpson, Roy Barnes, Ralph Litcher, Don Welch, they probably don't mean anything to many of you, but these were people who actually knew Mr. Goodrich when he was a young man. And so it's an interesting perspective, I think. I did take the opportunity to photograph or photocopy some pictures, and I didn't have enough to give to everyone, but I tried to put at least one on each table. So if you have a chance to look at those pictures, many of those pictures are of Mr. Goodrich when he was a young boy, and they're of the family. And that's kind of where I would like to start at. Mr. Goodrich, when I started to research his life, where do you start with a person? You start when the day they were born? Well, every time I started looking more at his life, I kept going back further and further to his father and to his mother, and then to his grandparents, and then back even further generations than that to try to understand him. Because if you take him out of context, I don't think you ever could understand anyone, let alone someone with the complexity of Pierre Goodrich. So I've spent a great deal of time learning about the Goodrich family. And I'm going to share with you just a few minutes about the Goodrich family. And then I want to talk a little bit more about Mr. Goodrich and his associations, the way that many of you would have become knowledgeable of Mr. Goodrich. First of all, Mr. Goodrich was the son of Governor James Goodrich. And there's a picture at the table of the five Goodrich brothers and their mother. And the five Goodriches, boys, they were the start of the family dynasty that had so many financial interests. Mr. Goodrich's grandfather came into Indiana as a baby. He was hand-carried in 1832. He came to Winchester, Indiana, and there he was raised, and he married a woman by the name of Elizabeth Edger. They had six boys. One of them passed away in infancy, and there were five Goodrich brothers. Mr. Goodrich's father, James Goodrich, was born in 1864 at the very end of the Civil War, and he wrote a diary, and this is where I've been able to get a lot of the information about the Goodrich family. Mr. Goodrich wrote this diary about his early days growing up in Winchester, and what a different time it was. They didn't have very much money. Everything they made was handmade. They chopped wood. They worked on the farm. They did anything. Mr. Goodrich's father was entrepreneurial from the very start when he was a young boy. In fact, by the time he was in high school, he was already making loans to less industrious companions and reaping quite a good reward, I guess, from that. He knew how to charge interest. Mr. Goodrich's father graduated from Winchester High School in 1881, and in his graduating class of nine, there was another gentleman by the name of Senator James Watson, who became U.S. Senate Majority Leader and who ran for president against Herbert Hoover in 1928. So here you had James Goodrich, who was governor of Indiana, state director of the Republican Party for 10 years. He was on the National Republican Committee for several years. And you had his best friend, who was Senator James Watson, who was Senate Majority Leader from 1929 to 1934. So it was a pretty, and I could go on with people who were in that class, it's a pretty impressive list of people graduating from class of nine. Mr. Goodrich, or James Goodrich, the future governor, married a woman by the name of Cora Frisk from nearby Lynn, Indiana. And in James Goodrich came back from having studied 2 years at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana, and he became a lawyer in Winchester. And there, in 1888, he was admitted to the bar, and he was making $50 a year as a lawyer, as a city attorney, in addition to whatever he could make on top of that. And he did this for 15 years. But towards the end of the 1800s, I think he learned that there must be a better way of making a living. And that's when he decided to get into the utility businesses. Now, I want to list to you just a few things. Mr. Goodrich's father, the utilities that he was involved with, because it's a rather sizable list. This was right around at the turn of this present century. It was the Union Heat, Light, and Power Company he was president of, Patoka Coal Company he was president of later on, the Railway Service and Supply Company, the Winona Railway Company, the Eastern Indiana Telephone Company, the Goodrich Brothers Hay and Grain Company, Citizens Heat, Light, and Power Company, and I could just go on and on. There were about five or six more companies that James Goodrich and the four other Goodrich brothers combined their resources and they bought into. And this was really the start of the Goodrich fortune, again around at the turn of the century. It was also at this time that James Goodrich in 1901 opened the People's Loan and Trust Bank. It was then known as the People's Loan and Trust Company in Winchester, Indiana. Now, I want to tell you just a little bit about Winchester because I think it's significant in understanding Mr. Goodrich and also about his family. Winchester was a community that was deeply patriotic, just like many small communities of this country. It had 24, in Randolph County, a county of about 29,000 at the time, had 2,400 men who fought in the Civil War. Five generals came from Randolph County. Two governors of Indiana came from Randolph County. An ambassador to Mexico, two presidential candidates came from the community. Around 1,400 men fought in World War I from Randolph County. In fact, if you go to the county today, the largest Civil War monument, county Civil War monument in the country, to my knowledge, is in Winchester. We locally raised $48,000 in the last year to restore the monument. It was put there in 1892. So this was a community that was deeply patriotic. Again, maybe not too dissimilar from other small communities, but I think to some degree, deeply patriotic, very politically active. During Mr. Goodrich's lifetime, five presidents came to Winchester and spoke at one time or another. And I put on the back picture of the list that you have is a picture taken in August 1939 when Herbert Hoover and his wife came and visited Governor Goodrich, and Pierre was also in that picture. Herbert Hoover and James Goodrich, Pierre's father, were very, very close friends. I'll share with you a little bit more. Pierre's father became extremely active in Republican politics. In 1897, he was the president of the Randolph County Republican Party. In 1899, he became chairman of the 8th Congressional District. And then in the year 1901, he became state Republican chairman. And he held that position until 1910. From 1912 to 1916, he was on the National Republican Committee. So James Goodrich was intricately involved in Republican politics at the state level and also at the national level. So Pierre obviously had tremendous contacts. I would think those would have been the years that he was growing up. Now, Mr. Goodrich graduated from Winchester High School in 1912. My great aunt, Alice Starbuck, graduated with him. He was one of 25. He went to Wabash College that year, and he matriculated at Wabash, and he majored in humanities, a BA in humanities. When he was a junior at Wabash, he was named Phi Beta Kappa. He was only one of two juniors at Wabash. And the following year, he graduated near the top or the top of his class out of 62 seniors graduating from Wabash. That was in 1916. That following fall, he matriculated at Harvard. And there at Harvard, he had three very well-known professors. One was Felix Frankfurter, who later became the U.S. Supreme Court Justice. He also had Roscoe Pound, who was dean of the Harvard Law School at that time. And that's a significant connection because later on, Roscoe Pound, Mr. Goodrich became friends with him and, in fact, had helped fund one of his major works, which was the five-volume set of jurisprudence. And also, Roscoe Pound came to Wabash College in the 1940s and delivered a series of lectures there. So there was a close connection between him and Mr. Goodrich. Mr. Goodrich, in 1920, graduated from Harvard. And I forgot to mention, in 1918, he was drafted. And so after his first year of Harvard, he spent a year and a half in the military. This was during World War I. And he was drafted, and he served in the Quartermaster Corps for that year and a half. He did not go overseas and fight, but he was in the military. He returned to Harvard, and he graduated in 1920. In 1920, he came back to Indiana. He married a woman by the name of Dorothy Dugan. They lived in Winchester, and they came back, and he practiced law with a gentleman by the name of John Macy. And John Macy was a gentleman who remained in Winchester the rest of his life. Pierre left after 3 years and came to Indianapolis. At this time, his father had finished his four-year term as governor of Indiana, and it was a very successful four-year term as governor. He started the Indiana State Parks Commission. He started the Conservation Commission, the State Highway Commission. It was a very successful four-year term for him as governor, but he decided he had had enough. He had a major tax revamping program which the legislature didn't adopt, and he was frustrated with that, and he had decided he was not going to go into politics anymore. And at that time, it was a one-term, you could only serve one term as governor. So James Goodrich, at that time, came back to Winchester. Pierre was in Winchester, and for that period of 1920 to 1923, they lived there in the small community. In 1923, as I mentioned, Pierre came, moved to Indianapolis. He thought he had greater fortunes here. And so he moved here and he started practicing law with a gentleman by the name of John Rabb Emison. And he practiced law with him for a couple years. And then in 1929, a gentleman by the name of Al Campbell, Bill's father, came on the scene. And Pierre practiced law with Al Campbell for the next... from 1929 to 1962, however many years that would be, 33 years, I guess. So Pierre had a practice here in Winchester, but it was really at that time that he took off with his business holdings. Governor Goodrich and the four Goodrich brothers had decided they were going to pool all their money. And Governor Goodrich, in 1927, there was a family meeting, and he told the Goodrich brothers, things do not look good. There is something wrong with this economy. And I don't know why it is that many bankers and many politicians didn't see it, but James Goodrich did. They liquidated all their holdings, or most of their holdings, in the public utilities. They sold off the coal companies, or the gas companies, and the electric companies, and the water companies, and the telephone companies. They sold them off, and they pooled their money into a corporation called Engineers Incorporated. And this was in 1927. And sure enough, and behold, a short time later, October of 1929, we had a depression. And it was at that time that they got back into the companies, and they were able to buy many companies for a pittance of what their value had been just a few years before. They bought what later became known as the Indiana Telephone Company. And Alan Russell could tell you a lot more about the Indiana Telephone Company than I ever can, but They bought that for a pittance in 1931-32 and sold it in the late 70s then for a tremendous sum. They also had, they kept holding on to the Patoka Coal Company. And the Patoka Coal Company merged with two other coal companies. One was Ayrshire Collieries, and Mr. Goodrich was two of seven board members on the Ayrshire Collieries board. And Al Campbell was the other, or when I say he was two of the board members from Patoka Coal. Al Campbell was the other board member. And so they remained on the board until 1940s when they had an opportunity to buy enough shares in Ayrshire Collieries that they gained controlling interest. And that's what Mr. Goodrich did in 1945. In 1946, Mr. Goodrich became the chairman of the Ayrshire Collieries Corporation. And this was a coal company which had coal fields in southern Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and later on in Wyoming. It was the 11th largest coal company in the United States, and Mr. Goodrich sold that in 1969, and I'll mention this later. Later it became known as AMAX Coal, which many of you are probably more familiar with than Ayrshire. Okay. James Goodrich also became involved with Eugene Pulliam. And Mr. Pulliam, as many of you know, was the owner of the Indianapolis Star, or became owner of the Indianapolis Star, the Indianapolis News, and the two largest Phoenix newspapers. Mr. Pulliam wanted to buy a radio station. It was WIRE here in Indianapolis. And at that time, I don't know why, but radio stations were going for a lot of money. I was surprised. My research found that it was about $300,000. It sounds like a lot to me. Maybe it was a mistake, but that was the research that I found, that was how much that radio station cost at that time. He went to the Goodriches, and the Goodriches were able to loan him money, and in turn, they got about a 25% share in the newspaper conglomerate that Eugene Pulliam had. Eugene Pulliam was not in good financial shape at the time. So that's how the Goodrich family got involved in what was known as Central Newspapers. There were City Securities. City Securities is the largest investment firm in Indiana and is one of the largest in the Midwest. And in 1931, a gentleman by the name of Dwight Peterson, who if you're not from Indianapolis, it probably doesn't mean anything to you, but Dwight Peterson was then nominally head of City Securities. They likewise were going into bankruptcy. And Dwight Peterson and James Goodrich got to know each other, and James Goodrich says, "I think I can help you out." And the Goodrich family gained 51% interest in City Securities. Now, I'm mentioning all this because this is really the foundation for which Peer entered then into the years that he served as CEO, board director of these various corporations. You had the Ayrshire Collieries Corporation. You had the Indiana Telephone Company, which Peer Goodrich served as chairman of from 1934 until his death. You had City Securities. You had People's Loan and Trust Bank still in Winchester. Mr. Goodrich became president when his father passed away. You had the Goodrich Brothers Hay and Grain Company. Now, this was Percy Goodrich. This was the governor's brother who was chairman of that, but Peer was a vice president. They owned 40 grain elevators in Indiana. They were the largest grain elevator owners in the state. So you can start to get a picture of these vast holdings that the Goodrich family had. Newspapers, coal, telephone. They bought up several small telephone companies. Eastern Indiana Telephone Company, Winchester is where I'm from, Public Telephone Company, Greensburg Telephone Company. And there's many others that Alan could tell you more about. So they had these vast interests. Okay, see if I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm trying to speak off the cuff a little bit here and not read from my notes. Okay, so you had Mr. Goodrich, who was involved in all these different corporations. It's interesting to note how the transition took place from father to son. James Goodrich was a phenomenal man. In addition to being governor and being involved in politics to the degree that he had really amassed this fortune in these companies. But he also did a lot of other things. He served on various commissions. It's just when I research James Goodrich and a good part of the biography on Peer, I'm also including about his father, because his father was just incredible how any one person could do that many things. He taught a men's Bible Sunday school class for 25 years, and that's significant in a way that I'll share with you later. He was a founding member of Rotary clubs and various service organizations. He received honorary doctorates from Notre Dame. He was chairman. He was served on the Wabash Board of Trustees for 36 years, and for 16 of those years, he was chairman. He served on the Public Lands Commission, appointed by Herbert Hoover. He served on the St. Lawrence Waterways Commission, appointed by Coolidge. He served, and this is a very significant thing, in Russia, various trips in the famine relief in the early 1920s. He went on four trips on behalf of President Warren Harding, and that was when 10 million Russians were starving to death. And Goodrich was the envoy. He was the lead man who went over and met with Stalin and Trotsky and Bukharin and Lenin. And he, between 1917 and 1933, was the highest official who met with those leaders on a regular basis. This is the governor, James Goodrich. So he, I have three chapters on just on that. Tremendous story. I wish I could spend a lot of time just telling you about that, because it's just fascinating, his trips back and forth to the Soviet Union, coming back and meeting with Harding and former Secretary Hughes in the White House and with Herbert Hoover. Okay. What's interesting then is you've got Peer Goodrich. Peer is now taking over the corporations, because the governor has had health problems. This is in the late 30s. Governor Goodrich had heart problems. And in fact, he went to John Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore because his heart problems were so serious in September of 1937. And it was interesting to read the letters that he would write back to Peer, and Peer would write to him, and Peer would say, "Well, Dad, what do you think I ought to do with this corporation, and what should I do here?" And Peer would write back, or James would write back to Peer, and he says, "Peer, I think you made a wise decision in selling stock here, and I think you made a wise decision in that." And it was this mentoring process that had to go on during much of their life together when they were in these corporations. Also, Peer had his four brothers that I mentioned. Percy, who was head of the grain elevators. Ed Goodrich, who was president of the Randolph County Bank. There were only two banks in Winchester. James was president of the People's Loan and Trust, and Ed was president of the Randolph County. Percy also was head of the electric company and coal. John Goodrich owned seven farms. So they had kind of a monopoly in that part of the state, as you can see. So this mentoring that went on, Peer didn't really have to look outside of his own family. And that's significant, and I'll touch upon this right now. If you go back to Winchester, I think this is true of any small town, but I think it's particularly true of Peer Goodrich, and this is maybe a perspective that another person who's writing the biography wouldn't spend time with. Peer lived within two blocks of his entire family. His grandmother lived on one block, and when she walked out her door, she used to say that she could see all five of her sons and their families where they lived. And in fact, that was true in Winchester. She had James, who lived over in this house here. Percy and John and Ed lived over here. And William Wallace, who was her youngest, lived right next door. And Peer grew up in that. I think it was a tremendous amount of stability. Peer's kindergarten teacher was his great aunt, Belle Edger, a phenomenal woman. His mother and his grandmother were two of nine women who founded the Winchester Library. The Presbyterian Church that was extremely important in Peer's life early on was right across the street. As I mentioned, the banks, the courthouse, which is still there, was built in 1878. All these institutions that I think shored up his personality, that helped create who he was in some sense, they were all within a radius of a few blocks. I think that's significant. I think that's significant later on for when he started this delving into philosophy, reading, and so forth. Peer had always been a bookworm. He'd always loved to read. In fact, his mother was very protective of him. I think because Pierre was an only child, his mother was very protective. She'd much prefer that he read a book or that he went to dances or he played the violin than if he'd go out swimming or played baseball. Pierre was always a bookworm, but it wasn't until the mid-1940s that he began to delve into these bigger issues. He became involved with the Mont Pelerin Society. He became involved with the Great Books Foundation. And I think there's a reason why. I'm doing a little psychoanalyzing, but not much, because I think it's pretty evident. In 1940, his father passed away, and I don't think there was really a need for him to prove himself anymore as a businessman. He had made it. He was president and CEO of Ayrshire. He was president of the Indiana Telephone Company. He was president of the People's Loan and Trust. He was on the board of directors and vice president of City Securities. Okay, he had made it as a businessman. And yet I think he saw something, he wanted something deeper, and he began to read. And also, it was World War II. It was devastating. That's evident. And so he was prime. So in 1947, he was asked to be a founding board member of the Great Books Foundation in Chicago with Mortimer Adler and with Robert Hutchins. And in fact, Pierre, if you know Pierre, and many of you did, when he got into something, he really got into it. And he got into great books. And what he did is he started creating big, great books chapters all over Indiana. In fact, he hired the superintendent of schools in Winchester to go out during the summer months when he wasn't employed to try to start great books chapters. And he started about 30 of them. In fact, Sullivan, Indiana, where Mr. Rice is from, Crawfordsville, Anderson, Columbus, Fort Wayne, a couple here in Indianapolis, Lynn, I've come across this. He started personally. He got a hold of community people and said, would you be willing to start a great books foundation? And he funded some of this through the Winchester Foundation, which is a foundation based in Winchester that contributes towards cultural, religious, and artistic endeavors. So Pierre really got involved in the Great Books Program. And in fact, he was involved from 1947 to about 1955. He also was invited in 1951 to the Mont Pelerin Society at Beauvallon, France. And that was extremely important to him because it was there at the Mont Pelerin Society that he became knowledgeable of and later established strong friendships with people like Hayek and von Mises and with Hunhold and with Repke and with Milton Friedman and with many other people that he later established long-term friendships with. Okay? It was during this period of time, Leonard, it was interesting that you were asked, Mr. Goodrich asked you, what do you think of Chinese civilization? Because I don't know quite how, but it was at this time in 1949 that Pierre became a board member of the China Institute in New York. The China Institute was founded back many years before, but it really just kind of existed as a society. And in the mid-40s, it had a mission. Now, Henry Luce was the chairman of the China Institute at this time. Elizabeth Luce Moore, who is his sister, I had a chance to talk to a couple years ago. She's 92 at the time, and she remembered Pierre very well. And so Pierre got extremely involved in Chinese history, in Chinese philosophy, in Chinese law. In fact, when Roscoe Pound went to China in 1947 and 1948 to advise the Chinese government on establishing a constitution, I think this was in 49 after the revolution, he came back and Pierre met with him. And Pierre got so excited that he asked if Pound would forward to him the constitution that he had proposed. And Pierre made all these notes, how it could be improved. And he shipped it off to Pound. So Pierre got very involved with the China Institute. And it wasn't just, it served a very serious purpose, because after 1949, many Chinese students who were here in this country couldn't go back to China. The UN, and at that time America, had a policy where they couldn't leave if they were going to a communist country. So many of them were forced to stay here. They didn't have jobs. So the China Institute and specifically the Finance Committee, which Peer was on, Charles Edison, who was then the governor of New Jersey and the son of Thomas Edison, he was chairman of that committee. Peer was on that committee. They raised money in order to try to find jobs for these Chinese students. And Peer remained on the China Institute board up until the mid-1960s. The Foundation for Economic Education, he became involved with in 1951. He remained on Fee's staff until his death in 1973. He was a stalwart supporter of Fee. I don't know about Mr. Goodrich's affiliation with the Philadelphia Society, but I know that he had one. I don't know what it was, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. There were so many, it's difficult. Now, one of the most significant was Wabash College. Leonard, how am I doing on time? Okay. If I'm running over, you let me know, okay? Okay. So at Wabash College, Peer took over his father's position on the Board of Trustees in 1940. Now, Governor Goodrich had been on the Board of Wabash College from 1904 to 1940, and he was chairman of the Board of Trustees. Peer took over that, and that was one of the most significant relationships he had. This was his alma mater. He cared deeply for Wabash College. It was there at Wabash College that he established friendships with three key people: Frank Sparks, Byron Trippett, and Ben Rogge. And Peer shuttled back and forth between Indianapolis and Crawfordsville many, many times, hundreds of times. He was constantly there. He was constantly trying to influence Wabash College, and specifically academically. Now, when I talked to some of the Board of Trustees who served during that period of time, they said, you know, we were in these board meetings, and we were trying to raise money, and all Peer wanted to do was talk about, well, this academic program, or have you read this book, or have you considered this seminar? And they said he would never want to talk about what we wanted to talk about. Well, Peer had his own agenda. And I think he was a little resented somewhat, but I also think they admired him. So he was on Wabash from 1940 to 1969 when he resigned. I think Wabash always hoped that they would be the beneficiary of the Goodrich fortune. There had been this, for 65 years, Peer and his father served on the Board of Trustees. And I think they compared him a lot to Eli Lilly. Now, Eli Lilly wasn't a graduate of Wabash, but he served on the board at the same time that Peer did. And Eli Lilly contributed over his lifetime nearly $40 million in Lilly stock. And I think they had their eye on Peer to do the same. They were sorely disappointed. It doesn't mean that Peer didn't contribute greatly. And if you talk to anyone who remembers during those years, they said that he didn't. They did, and he contributed financially, but it was not maybe as what they'd hoped for. So we're up to about the 50s. Peer got off the board of the Great Books, and Bill Dennis made this observation, and I think it's probably a good one. One of the problems with the Great Books Foundation, I think Peer felt, Bill made this point, and I think it's true, is the Great Books, Peer thought, loved to talk about ideas. But Peer thought there were certain ideas that were more important than others. And he, through all his years of experience, of serving on all these boards, of serving on all these boards of associations, corporate boards, I think Peer realized that liberty was a fundamental core idea that was deserving of more study than something like the Great Books Foundation was willing to give. You got to remember that Mr. Goodrich didn't found the Liberty Fund until 1960. He was 66 years of age at that time. So this came on rather late in his career. So Peer had a great deal of time to think about this. So in fact, he started this in 1960, and here we have Mr. Rice, who was a founding board member at that time, Don Welch, Ben Rogge. Many others who you might know were with Peer, and he started the Liberty Fund. But he still hadn't liquidated his companies at that time, so the Liberty Fund didn't really have the resources that it would later have. There were only 10 conferences, about 10, that were held during Peer's lifetime, Liberty Fund conferences. And there was a decision whether or not to make for the Liberty Fund to be a grant-making or an operating foundation. Again, I feel a little bit intimidated talking among so many Liberty Fund board members who are here who probably know far more about Liberty Fund than I do. But I think it was a little uncertain what the direction Liberty Fund was going to go. What was interesting, if you look at how Liberty Fund is formed today, it's an amalgamation, really, of all what Pierre had learned from his association with the other entities. From the Great Books Foundation, he believed that core readings from great books should serve as the core for seminars. He believed that the Socratic method, as opposed to the lecture method, would be the best approach towards learning. From the Foundation for Economic Education, I believed he learned from Leonard Reed the significance of having people in influential positions, moral positions, be the attenders of these seminars. People in academics, people in the media, people in government, judges, business people. I think from the Mont Pelerin Society, he learned that there's a need for a camaraderie, that there was no need to have people who had totally different opinions being there. You're probably never going to change their minds, but there should be a dialogue, it shouldn't be an antagonistic endeavor, but there should be a serious dialogue. So you had all these things coming together, and then you had the sale of the companies. Now, Mr. Goodrich sold the Ayrshire Collieries in 1969, and there was a reason why. One is he was getting older. He was 73 at the time. The president of Ayrshires was Norman Kell, but he was 75. They either are going to have to get younger management in, or they're going to have to sell it. And Pierre decided to liquidate the holdings in his companies. And in fact, he sold it to American Metal Climax for a little over $100 million. The Goodrich family at that time owned about 44%. Pierre's personal profit, I think, somewhere in the range of $25 to $30 million. And he was able to have that money transferred into the Liberty Fund Foundation. And that really was where the resources came for the Liberty Fund to do a lot of their work later on. Now, another significant person that I failed to mention was a gentleman by the name of Bill Casey. Now, Bill Casey, who many of you probably know more as the director of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the director of the CIA, and as President Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign chairman, he was a tax lawyer, and he was a very good tax lawyer. And Pierre had met Bill Casey at the 1952 Republican National Convention in Chicago. Henry Rignery had introduced him. And Pierre and William Casey, very similar in some ways, they developed a friendship. And so Pierre had Bill Casey do a lot of his tax work, and Bill Casey is really responsible for doing a lot of the legal work, a lot of the preparation of the Liberty Fund. Okay. I think I need to look at my notes just a little bit here. Let me talk to you about something else that when I thought, what do I talk about? The biography that I'm writing right now is 350 to 400 pages, and to try to bring that down to a 30-minute talk is difficult. There's so many different facets of Mr. Goodrich's life that one could talk about. And I'll show you why I developed an interest in the Goodrich family. One is, Mr. Rice is here, and he'll know this very well, was Meadowlark Farms. Now, I couldn't understand why a businessman, an attorney, an intellectual like Pierre Goodrich would have such an interest in ecology. Pierre Goodrich had a deep interest in ecology, in conservation, in environmental matters, and I couldn't quite grasp that. Well, then I learned about what his father had done during his years as governor. I learned what he did as a private citizen, and it started to make more sense. Well, during the time that Ayrshire Collieries was in operation, they owned up to 150,000 acres. Is that right? Okay. Right around there, 150,000 acres in Indiana and Illinois and Kentucky. And here they were strip mining. And the land, after it was strip mined, looked like moon craters. And Pierre hired a gentleman by the name of Richard Lieber, who had served under his father. And Pierre said, I think there ought to be something done. This land ought to be made productive. But the problem was twofold. One, there wasn't any federal or state legislation that required it. In fact, federal legislation I don't think occurred until the 70s, 1970s. But the real problem with doing something with this land, all these thousands of acres that was being, in one sense, almost destroyed, was that there wasn't any economic incentive to do it. And Peer, out of very thin profit margins, had to devise a way in order to reclaim this land. And so Peer, being the innovative thinker that he was, hired Richard Lieber, Mr. Rice, he later hired, I believe, in 1948. Meadowlark Farms was started in 1945. And the sole purpose of Meadowlark Farms was to reclaim this land, to make it productive again, to turn it back into agricultural land, to make it good for grazing, for raising crops. Lakes were built. Reservoirs were built. Recreational areas. And Peer was very successful. In fact, people from other states came and looked at Meadowlark Farms. That's just one small aspect of Peer that I found interesting. Let me close by just mentioning a few things. First of all, Mr. Goodrich, the title of the talk was Unknown and Remarkable. He wasn't very well known, and I think Mr. Goodrich didn't really care whether or not he was known or not. I received letters from people who said that even though they had been around Peer for years, they didn't know if they really knew him, and Peer just didn't seem to have an interest. He went to discuss what he wanted to discuss, not to tell people about his accomplishments or his abilities, and it was his personality. It was funny last evening when you mentioned about the promptness. I got a letter from Russell Kirk, and Mr. Kirk said, I got a call one night from Peer, and Peer had said that he had called Mr. Russell earlier that day at 9 o'clock, his library, and no one answered, and he wanted Mr. Russell to know that, or Russell Kirk to know that, because he was afraid that he might want to inform his employees that they ought to be on time. Peer's personality is a story in and of itself, and I'll end up by just giving you a few stories. Peer had an incredible memory. You didn't dare tell Peer anything, because 6 months later he could tell you verbatim what you told him, and he'd hold you to it. When he would hire people, and again, Alan Russell could share with you much more, and Alan did. I enjoy talking with Alan about this very much. Peer, when he would hire someone, he would talk to them for hours, maybe days. Alan mentioned that when he went in for an interview, I think it was 2 days long, and he wanted you to stay for an extra day. That was Peer. He wanted to know everything he could about you. I talked with a woman down in Liberty, Indiana, and her sister, they lived right next to Peer, and in 1921, she can remember this, and this was 2 years ago that I talked to her, she says, we were sitting in the dining room waiting for my sister to come in, and we saw Peer and my sister, and they were out on the street corner, and they were talking. Now, that wouldn't be so unusual, but it was a torrential downpour. And her sister had an umbrella, and Peer didn't. And he was getting soaked. And Alice Miller came in, and he says, what happened? She goes, I tried and tried and tried to get away from Peer, but he kept telling me about this poetry, and I couldn't get away from him. Once he got on a subject, and if it interested him, he could talk about it forever. His inflation. He became an expert on inflation. He wrote anyone who knew anything about inflation. There are various subjects that he became an expert in. Indian mysticism. I'll read to you out of a book. I found this. This is a book that was written by Edward Gallahue, and he was president of the American States Insurance. And I just came across this in looking through the book, and I found Peer's name. This is just one paragraph. This is how Peer did business. Gallahue, at the time, was trying to buy the Union Insurance Company from Peer, who owned it. in 1941. And Gallahue writes, "Peer was a very gracious person. And if he wanted to take up part of our meeting talking about Greek philosophy and Asiatic mysticism, it was all right with me, for I had some knowledge of these subjects and would at least find them interesting. He was a highly intelligent person who simply approached matters differently from most businessmen. Instead of moving directly from A to B, he chose to surround the subject in concentric circles. While his method took longer, it was effective in covering every item. Finally, after several months, Pierre and I arrived at the basis for a sale." I'll close, and then if we do have time for questions, I would be glad. John Macy, who he practiced law with from 1920 to 1923, and who I remember very well, having grown up in Winchester, his daughter was a young, impressionable young lady when she first met Peer. Her name is Anna Marie Gibbons, and she still lives in Winchester. And on Peer's passing on October 25th, 1973, the next day she wrote, "Peer Goodrich," in the paper, she was a reporter for the Winchester paper, "Peer Goodrich, who died in Indianapolis Thursday evening at 79, was probably the most remarkable Hoosier of this century in terms of intelligence, range of interest, and financial acumen. Peer was difficult to talk to or to listen to, partly because he spoke in a soft, hesitant voice, and partly because his mind darted from thought to thought with such dazzling speed it was too much for the average person to follow. But if you followed, you found the tour both fascinating and rewarding. If you tried to catalog all the things he became interested in his lifetime, you would find the list amazing. And whatever he became interested in, he learned from the inside out, totally and entirely. Peer was so totally engrossed with the world of ideas that he often lost complete track of time when he became involved in a conversation or discussion that interested him and had to be reminded by a tug at his sleeve or coattail that it was time to be going. The tug that told him Thursday evening, that was the night that he passed, that it was time to be going, was one he couldn't disregard. But I'm sure he left as reluctantly as ever. Not because he was so tied to the things of this world, but because he had a few thousand ideas which he still had not had time to explore and think about, and a few thousand questions his amazing brain had still not had time to find answers for. Thank you very much.